We call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this wonderful March, what?
Third.
For March 3rd. My plan today is to go in sort of reverse order. I'm going to start with 2300 because I think this should be a very brief public hearing. And then we'll go to the 2387. But when I open 2387 for public hearing, I'm also going to open 2116 in case anybody wants to comment on both bills at the same time. But we'll focus on, at that point, on 2387. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2300. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2300 comes to the committee at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. It requires the cost of mental health drugs to be taken into consideration in determining the global budgets for the care organizations. And we have three folks signed up, Mr. Chair.
Would you call them, please?
Jim Rickards, Justin Black, and then Brian Martin.
Morning, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose. I'm Jim Rickards with the Oregon Health Authority. I'm the Chief Medical Officer with the OHA. Thank you for having me here this morning to speak to House Bill 2300, the often called Mental Health Drug Carve-Out of the Oregon Health Plan. To give some background, in 2001, the Oregon Legislature passed Senate Bill 819, which created the Practitioner-Managed Prescription Drug Plan, the PMPDP. The PMPDP required the Oregon Health Plan to maintain a list of the most cost-efficient drugs to prescribe for fee-for-service Medicaid members. This list is the so-called Preferred Drug List, or PDL. In 2003, the legislature passed House Bill 3624, which prohibited the Department of Human Services, who at the time administered the Oregon Health Plan, from establishing capitation rates that included payment for mental health drugs, or is often referred to as the mental health drug carve-out. Finally, in 2009, the legislature passed House Bill 2126 and defined mental health drugs as those drugs in therapeutic classes 7, atoractics and tranquilizers, and 11, psychostimulants and antidepressants, and exempted placement on the PDL as a condition of payment. Therefore, since 2009, DHS and OHA have paid for mental health drugs on a fee-for-service basis with little restrictions or controls. As written, House Bill 2300 would end the carve-out for mental health drugs and include those drugs in the global budget process. Thus, coordinated care organizations, or CCOs, would manage and pay for mental health drugs and could implement their own restricted drug lists, or PDLs, for mental health drugs, as they currently have for physical health drugs. In addition to handing over coverage responsibility for mental health drugs to CCOs, ending the carve-out would have several benefits, including allowing CCOs to have direct access to mental health drug claims, helping them protect patient safety and manage complex medical conditions, enabling CCOs to further advance care coordination by being fully responsible for all aspects of their members' care, streamlining information and reducing confusion for health practitioners that treat CCO members, and allowing CCO members to access CCO pharmacy networks, which often extend out of state, reducing delays or confusion for members who travel. Thank you again for your time and allowing me to speak to House Bill 2300. I will now let Justin Black talk about a possible amendment to the bill.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Justin Black. I'm the Director of Government Relations at OHA. The Oregon Health Authority spends approximately $130 million per year on mental health drugs paid through fee-for-service. The governor's budget includes an estimated $8.2 million general fund savings from this amount by allowing the Oregon Health Authority to enforce a mental health PDL starting January 2, 2018. OHA is working on an amendment to House Bill 2300 to achieve these savings and to to protect OHB members who need mental health drugs. The amendment will likely include an enforceable PDL with safeguards such as language to grandfather members and a current course of treatment so they're not impacted by the introduction of an enforceable mental health PDL. It's important to keep two things in mind while thinking about the upcoming move to an enforceable mental health PDL. First, although OHA cannot currently enforce a PDL for mental health drugs, we do publish a voluntary PDL for prescribers, and current compliance with the voluntary PDL is about 77%. Contrast that with the enforceable physical health PDL, which has compliance rate of about 95%. This already relatively high compliance rate to the voluntary PDL, along with the grandfathering provisions, suggests that the overall impact to current OHP members would be rather small. Second, as the 95% physical health drug compliance rate suggests, non-placement on the PDL does not prohibit access to drugs. Prescriber overrides and other exceptions exist that would apply to an enforceable mental health PDL. And just a side note, so we are trying to work with advocates and CCOs to see if we can come to kind of an agreeable solution. The agency has presented this very concept, the concept in House Bill 2300, a couple times during the legislative session, prior legislative sessions, and has not made any movement forward. So we are trying to find kind of an agreeable solution in this space.
Are there questions?
I have a quick question.
Yes, go
ahead. Is the $8 million in savings that you talked about from the original bill or the amended?
I believe it's from the amended. The governor's budget, Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, my understanding is that the governor's budget included an enforceable PDL, not what is in House Bill 2300.
Thank you. We have a couple of other folks who would like to speak on the bill. Will you call them, please?
Chris Bonoff and Courtney Johnston.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today on behalf of Coalition for Healthy Oregon, which is an association of eight coordinated care organizations and affiliated healthcare providers who serve nearly half of the state's Medicaid patients. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2300. The coordinated care model was created to manage through a network of healthcare providers, coordinating both physical, dental, and mental health, and we're tasked with treating the whole body, including the mind. As we all know, mental illness is one of the most complex health issues our patients can have, especially when you consider how many suffer from dual diagnosis of mental illness and addictions. Unfortunately, we're hampered in our efforts to serve these patients because we are one part of this care lives in a silo, and that is these drugs. Mental health drugs are complicated care to manage, as these drugs need to be monitored carefully and often need to be adjusted to ensure that they are working properly. When our patients travel out of state and run out of these prescriptions, our CCOs are routinely getting calls. But because the OHA, as the managing entity, doesn't do prior authorizations, these folks oftentimes can't get their drugs. What we have today is a clunky system, which in cases can result in people not getting the care they need. And it's imperative on us to improve this system and better incorporate behavioral health under the CCO and manage these benefits in a way that provides better care to our patients. Managing these drugs is expensive and complicated, but evidence shows that people on 7-Eleven drugs benefit from the care that the CCOs provide. We're concerned about the current gaps in care that this system has now, and so we're supporting House Bill 2300 to try to reduce those gaps. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonoff. I'm here representing the National Alliance of Mental Illness. We're a grassroots organization composed entirely of people affected by mental illness. We take these medications. We interact with the CCOs. We interact with the insurance companies. And if we were really here talking about coordinated care, we'd be here eagerly, but we're not. CCOs don't even coordinate our care now. And then they're asking to take on more of that business without doing a good job with our population now. We agree these are very complex medications, and if we were talking about quality, we'd be here eagerly. What we're really talking about here right now is restricting access to medications. This has nothing to do with coordinated care. This has nothing to do with quality prescribing, and this has very little to do with savings. Most of our medications now are generic, with the exception of one or two products that are newer on the market and long-term injectables, which have such a small claim count as to be very negligible to our budget because they're not prescribed lightly. So rather than talking about coordinated care, let's talk about what this bill really does, both the bill itself and the amendment. The bill itself puts us on 16 different formularies. In our system, we are shipped all across the state. What care provider, what acute crisis system is going to be able to track 16 different formularies? With restricted access, we have predictable results. We know. We live with this as individuals and families with mental illness. As NAMI, we live with this daily, helping families, helping individuals overcome all the administrative barriers to accessing medications. This is what happens to us when we have restricted access. We go without. We walk away. We fail on the meds that they start us on because it isn't about individual prescribing. It's about this is what we're going to try everybody on, and you're going to fail first on this before we give you access to that. And this is about actual bad outcomes. The human cost, the human hours we put in to help people overcome the administrative barriers put in the way just to deny us access, that takes a toll not only on the man hours that we put in, but it also takes a toll on the actual costs to our system and actual poor outcomes. And these are things that we live with daily. Because we know these things, the state has made a conscious decision, along with the federal government in our Medicare program, to protect access to these medications. These medications, unlike many other classes of medications, they are not interchangeable. What works for me is not going to work for somebody else. What causes a side effect in me is not going to cause a side effect in somebody else. And what we really want to talk about, what we want to get at, and what we've been trying to do year after year after year after year that this comes up, is get to the issue of quality prescribing. And that's what we should be talking about. We have been so eager for that conversation, and year after year after year, we've been told that's not the conversation we're going to have. This state has a wonderful example of what we're talking about, and you'll see that as a something that we submitted. It's on OLIS. We have been desperate to have a conversation about prescribing algorithms, decision trees, helping get at the real problem, which is making sure that when somebody is about to prescribe me a medication, that they are doing so based on my individual need, my potential side effects, what I'm going to respond best to, and in a way that gives me an informed choice.
Well, Chris, let's do that. Let's take this opportunity to begin that conversation.
Chair Greenlee, I would love to, and we keep trying, and it's frustrating because as an advocacy organization, everybody tells us what's best for us, whether it's industry, whether it's the OHA, whether it's insurance companies, and yet nobody will sit down with us and seriously talk about what we're talking about. And I still, Opal K, you know, it's the psychiatric kids line. It's known as a phone line, but one of the real gems it produced is guidelines that help people prescribe individually. And it does address costs, and we're not against cutting costs, and we're not against trying the least expensive product if an individual prescriber determines that, yes, that's a medication that you may respond to and may tolerate. And so, Chair, I would love that conversation.
All
we
right.
would love to be...
Let's start that conversation with this bill. I've been watching it for the same 15 years you have, and I think it is time for that conversation.
I would welcome that. Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
All right, we'll figure out how to facilitate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'm curious, because I think part of the dilemma that we face as legislators is we don't have unlimited resources when it comes to costs, and we're going to talk about that here in the next bill in just a minute. Does your organization support looking at some ways that we can deal with costs in terms of the prices we get from drug manufacturers?
We're open to that conversation. Our bottom line is because our medications are so unusual and so unique compared to other medications, and our individual responses vary, and because we don't understand really the mechanisms as to one why I may take one antipsychotic and it has no effect on me and another antipsychotic does, is that we want access. Where we have always felt, particularly now, that almost all of our stuff is generic, and it is. That the cost savings is so negligible compared to the risks we are going to take in endangering people's lives. But yes, we are open to that conversation. And like I said, I mean, when we talk about algorithms, one of the things you'll see in the exhibit that we submitted is cost is a factor. Educating prescribers about cost.
In past years, your organization has not been very responsive to algorithmic care.
We actually have been suggesting this since 2012. So this is something we have tried to do. We tried to do a pilot in Central Oregon. We were not successful with legislation in allowing us to do that. We have been advocating for it for at least 5 years now. Prior to that, you may be correct, Chair.
Well, I'm going to ask. I'm going to try and put together some folks to work with you to try and deal with that.
Thank you so much.
I think it is time to address this seriously.
We wholeheartedly agree. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2300. I'll try and do what I can to get some folks together to discuss this topic. I think it is time for that serious discussion. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2387, and incidentally also open a public hearing on House Bill 2116, but we'll only talk about 2116 incidentally. We'll focus mostly on 2387, but it'll give you a chance to comment on 2116 if you want. What do we have at 2387, or should we let Representative Noss?
Yes. And Mr. Chair, do you want me to bring up the next two folks with Rep. Noss, or wait till he's
ready? We can do it either way.
Go for it.
Okay. Here we go. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here in front of you, and I'm not just saying that. For the record, my name is Rob Noss, and I'm the state representative for House District 42, which consists of inner southeast and a little slice of northeast Portland. They don't like to be forgotten, so I have to mention them. In my first term, one of the most gut-wrenching days for me on this committee was when people came and literally spilled out their purses and their shopping bags with the various medications that they take to stay alive, to function as parents, or to go to work. And they would describe the struggles that they face to afford these medications and the trade-offs they make in that process. I'm lucky in that for the most part, I've had good health and good health insurance. These folks were clearly working class and middle class people trying to be productive members of our state who desired to contribute, yet they lack jobs with good health insurance or they're on exchange plans with very high deductibles and hefty cost-sharing mechanisms once that insurance benefit actually kicks in. This problem was really well illustrated by a story about Gloria Rogers in a recent Portland Business Journal article. Now, Gloria was 4 and a half. She was diagnosed with a rare genetic mutation that caused seizures. She was hospitalized for 2 weeks. Her condition continued to deteriorate, and she lost the ability to swallow and eat by mouth. After she was airlifted to Portland, doctors diagnosed her with infantile spasms and prescribed, I hope I'm saying this right, Acathar, which is a frontline treatment for this syndrome. Now, there was only one problem. This drug costs $35,000 a vial. Now, at first, her parents thought this medication was some sort of experimental treatment, or it had just been recently invented. In fact, the drug has been around since the 1950s, and it was off patent. In 2001, Questar Pharmaceuticals bought the rights to Acathar, which at that time cost $40 a vial, and they raised the price 85,000%. I'm going to say that again, 85,000%. Now, in 2015, We had two bills in this committee, one to cap copays on exchange plans for specialty drugs to no more than $100 for a 30-day supply, and another to require transparency or reporting to the state for any drug that cost over $10,000 a year as to why. Was it marketing or R&D costs or something else? Neither of these bills were moved out of this committee, as the chair wisely decided to marry those two things together, form a root group, and attempt to solve the problem of the growing expense of medications more holistically. So since August of 2015, I've been chairing a work group that met monthly, composed of representatives from across the healthcare industry to try to get at this problem, the expense of medications. The work group was made up of Representatives Kenemer and Lively, and advocates from the pharmaceutical industry, insurance companies, inpatient groups, in the hopes of crafting legislation to make prescription drugs more affordable. This has not been an easy problem to solve. The way drugs are developed and the way they are paid for makes solving this problem very hard. Let me start with a few slides that I think illustrate the problem. Now, the first slide that's up on the screen shows a trend line over a decade showing the skyrocketing costs of medications, particularly those that are deemed specialty drugs. Specialties are usually newer drugs to the market, often biologics. They treat cancers or chronic conditions, and they are special because they are new or expensive or because of the way they are administered. Now, this next slide shows five common medications where the price has increased a lot since 2007, way beyond inflation. This next slide juxtaposes regular inflation with pharmaceutical and medical inflation, right? You can see the trend line, the blue line on the bottom, and then pharmaceutical and medical inflation. Those are the bar graphs. Now, this slide is a little busy, but it reveals why this is a growing problem. 1% of the drugs utilized today are 50% of the expense of all the drugs that are used. And this is only going to continue. Mr. Chair, I believe you whispered to me at one of those meetings I was chairing, based on a trade show that you attended in the spring of 2016, that we're going to be, and I remember you saying this, overwhelmed in the next few years with these kinds of medications coming onto the market. Now, this next slide shows the cost problem again, although it does it differently, with the amount of money spent on medications over almost 40 years and what the spend projections are for medications if we do not do anything about the costs. And this last slide, how many of you have heard about Hep C drugs Sovaldi? It debuted at $80,000 for its 12-week course of treatment, and at least to its credit, it is a cure. But this is not the only drug that is like this in the pipeline. And with that kind of cost, that is what this slide is attempting to show. That's it for the slides. We can turn the lights back up. Now, when it came to trying to develop legislation, us legislators came up with three criteria. We wanted ideas for a bill that would do something to help patients save money and reduce their costs, do something that does not cause the overall premium to rise very much, and get drug manufacturers to be more reasonable about what they charge. House Bill 2387 addresses these three criteria by doing the following. It calls for transparency about what drives the cost of pharmaceuticals with regard to research and development, marketing, how much profit is needed, as well as coupons and patient assistance that's offered, so that we can gain some insight into why drugs are priced the way that they are. It puts a dollar amount, a copay cap, on what consumers have to pay for each 30-day prescription of $100 once the bill is amended. The current cap in the bill is more aggressive, but probably not workable. Finally, it creates a rebate system, and we're going to have to amend this a little as well, but the intent is this. If a drug manufacturer charges a price for a drug in Oregon that is higher than the average price charged among the next top five nations for that drug among the member nations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The difference between that average price and what is charged to Oregon will be rebated to the insurers. Now, that is a bit of a mouthful. What I'm trying to say is that if you charge more in Oregon than you charge in other developed countries, you'll have to pay a rebate to the payer for the difference. That is so that premiums won't increase because of the copay cap. After all, is it really right that Oregonians are charged more than what people in Sweden or Canada or France are charged? Now, obviously, look behind me, this bill is not without its detractors. And not surprisingly, drug manufacturers, I believe they're opposed to this bill. It does not set a price. It requires a rebate under certain conditions. Healthcare providers in Oregon have been trying to keep healthcare costs reasonable, but they can't do it if the pharmaceutical industry does not change the way that it prices medications. This is a very aggressive bill, and we're among one of the first states in our country to go at this problem in this manner. Now, I believe the critics are going to say some of the following, that this is a windfall to insurance carriers. I've been assured by the Department of Consumer and Business Services that that is not true, despite the full-page ad that has been taken out for the second day in a row in the Oregonian, which I can't help but reflecting on the fact that the transparency that we require for the insurance industry makes it possible for them to cite the amount of money they're claiming that the insurance industry earns in this state. The rate-setting process in this state is that if there is a windfall that the carriers experience as a result of the rebates that are required by this bill, that has to be reflected back in the rates that they develop or given to the plan purchasers, in addition to the copay benefit that they will receive. And if that is in question, I believe there are staff here from DCBS who can offer some insight into the rate-setting process. And I'm going to have, if not, I've got an email that I'll have posted to OLIS that explains this in a little more detail. You may hear that the free market will or is addressing this problem. And I would call your attention to an investigation that was done by KGW where they showed 100 drugs that went up in almost every instance more than 71% over a four-year period. So they've got a great little thing on their website. It's very interactive. You can drag a cursor over a drug and see what the price is. So here's one, tetracycline. It's an antibiotic, okay? Since 2012 to 2016, it went from 7 cents to $8.54. Now, that's a generic, you know, and that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but that is a 12,100% increase in 4 years.
That's per pill.
Per pill. Here's another one that maybe some people have heard of, acyclovir. It's for cold sores. And it's also generic. Per pill, it was 15 cents in 2012, and now it's 65 cents. And that's a 323% increase in 4 years. 100 different drugs that they looked at that are experiencing this. Usually a free market brings costs down. You'll hear that innovation will be stifled and the regulation reporting is burdensome. I don't think the critics of that bill are entirely true about that. The financing of industry research is different than the marketing and mass production and selling of the product once you have something that is actually workable. Often, biotech companies that develop these drugs sell their company or their discoveries to one of the larger, more established companies, and then the whole financing scheme changes. Now, I do have a letter. I don't think it's on OLIS yet. We'll submit it. That'll be on the record from one of these companies that has come forward and said this bill, is not going to hurt their ability to generate financing and that something needs to be done. If there's a way to have reporting and transparency and do it in a way that is not as burdensome for small startup companies, I'm open to hearing some of those suggestions. You may also hear that drugs that cost a lot are anomalies and not that commonly prescribed. The list compiled by KGW that I submitted on OLIS is only drugs that have gone up 71% or greater in 4 years. 100 drugs is hardly just a blip or an isolated case, in my opinion. Now, you will also hear that regulation reporting, the transparency part of this bill, is burdensome. The bill asks for the following only if you charge more than $10,000 a year for the drug. What is your average wholesale price? A rationale for that price, including cost of development, research, clinical cost trials, manufacturing costs, safety and efficacy testing costs, desired margin, marketing budget, and how you are conducting marketing. Is it direct to consumer versus direct to provider? That might be burdensome, but I'm guessing that any project manager or person in charge of that drug's development knows how to answer this. Maybe they have to spend a day gathering that info up and putting in one report if they don't already have it, but I'm guessing they have it for their investors. Mr. Chair, thank you for tasking me with chairing this work group. It was a very good hazing. I learned a lot. I know this is a very aggressive bill, first of its kind, but it is absolutely what is needed. I also think it's important to understand that I didn't get a lot of meaningful ideas from the pharmaceutical industry about what they would be willing to do to control cost. Their only answer to me was that they're not the problem, and that we should focus on other areas that are cost drivers, like hospital costs. I'm going to say on the record, I was disappointed they weren't here on Wednesday to hear me talk about that issue. I'm hopeful they'll be helpful in encouraging our state to look at a rate-setting process for hospitals. In the meantime, I'm still open to listening to other approaches and ways to implement the bill that are not as burdensome. Perhaps your hiccup idea will be the right approach.
Representative Nose, I want to comment that whether the folks on your work group agree with the final product that you've come up with or not.
We didn't.
They universally admired your work on that committee, and I think you did a fantastic job, and we all owe you big time for the sweat and effort that went into the project.
Yeah. You ready?
All right, stop clapping. Okay. Are there questions, or should we move forward?
We have a lot of people.
That means we can't ask questions?
No, I'm just saying.
No, go ahead.
We've
no, go ahead.
Three pages.
Okay. We have 3 pages of people who are going to ask to be very brief in their testimony.
Yeah, like Chair Green, like I appreciate you taking on a really difficult, sticky problem that needs to be solved, and I think you did an outstanding job defining the problem. The solution, though, I think we can debate a little bit.
Okay.
Wouldn't you say this is a national problem and not just an Oregon problem?
I would agree with that.
So wouldn't it be best to have a national solution?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, until super recently, with the change of politics in this country, I think most of us have been very cynical about the ability to get a national solution, and that often things have to start in the states to get Congress or the president to do anything different. Now, we have heard rumblings that President Trump wants to take this on, and he wants to do it for Medicaid, Medicare, in exchange, you know, for the ability to have the ability to negotiate price for those, that he would speed up the FDA process in terms of bringing drugs to market and research. And we'll see if that happens. I've thought about putting a banner in front of our healthcare dais, but I didn't think it would be well received. Where, yes, I know, Sandy saying I wouldn't have been allowed to do it. But where recently President Trump was quoted as saying healthcare is complicated. I think it was in the Thursday Times.
You don't think he's right about
New
that?
York Times. So, you know, that might be an approach that helps one aspect of this, but this bill is focused on what we might do in the commercial space.
One more question, please.
Please.
So, my biggest concern is that this would have the opposite effect, that Oregon's a small flyover state, that Oregonians could be deprived, actually, of critical life-saving drugs that pharmaceutical companies would just pass over Oregon, especially with new innovative drugs, these specialty drugs you refer to.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, boy, I hope that's not the case. I think that'd be incredibly mean. I hope they do not do that.
Okay, thank you. We, as I say, we have several witnesses. Well, let me just open 2116 for a moment. And I don't want to, 2116 is my bill. I don't want to be confused. I support 2387. 2116 is there as a backup if we run into problems. I can't imagine why there's any barriers to passing this bill, but in case there is, we have 2116 available. Basically, it does a very simple thing. It creates a safe pool. It takes all these high-cost drugs and puts the reimbursement for those drugs into a safe pool, and it taxes the pharmaceutical industry on their gross sales in Oregon to support that those bills. 2387 is the bill we're working in reality today. Would you call the first panel? We're going to alternate pro and con in the panels. We're going to ask you all to stick to 2 minutes if you can. We have a lot of folks.
First panel is Robert Judge and Jacob Thompson. Well, and Diane Solomon, you want to come up too?
Any order, just identify yourself.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Judge. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Services at Moda Health. Moda Health is a Northwest insurer providing dental, medical, and pharmacy services to about 1.2 million people in the Northwest. In addition to that, we also provide coverage pharmacy services for OEB, PEB, SAFE, CCO, and many self-insured or fully insured organizations in Oregon. I'm here really to support, express support for the 2387. I think Representative Noss did an excellent job of kind of overviewing the problem or the challenge that insurers face. From MOTA's perspective, we live this issue every day. We've seen that the share of specialty pharmaceuticals or high-cost medications, the share that makes of our total healthcare spend increase since 2010 by about 10% to about 33%. So 33% of our healthcare spend is now composed of medications. That compares with kind of a national trend of about 17% that occurred in 15 or was seen in 2015. But the real issue is around the high cost specialty medications. And we've seen those medications since 2012 increase about, or 2010, I'm sorry, increase about 250% in terms of the share that they represent of our total pharmacy spend. It was about 10% in 2010, and now it's about 36%. And so that's a really interesting perspective when you say 36% of the costs that we spend on pharmaceuticals are these high-cost medications that treat 2% of our population and account for 1% of the drugs that we that we pay for. So it's an incredible burden, and at a rate of a growth of about 20-25% annually in pharmacy spend costs, it's unsustainable. And it forces, it puts insurers in the very uncomfortable position of having to figure out how to provide full service, full care coverage for our members, broad access to medications, and still do it in an affordable way. And I think 2387 takes significant steps towards, you know, helping consumers and payers deal with this. I view it as a
please wrap it up here.
I view it as having both consumer protection elements, which are addressed through the copay caps, and I just want to spend a moment on that. Copay caps, I think, is a laudable and very worthwhile initiative, and it's one that, while we weren't excited to see in the bill, we support it because it's a shared obligation that we have as an industry to try to provide affordability and consumer protection for the medications and the health services we provide. But it has to be part of an integrated bill. To tear it out, as I'm sure that there are advocates to do, will end up not solving any bit of the problem because prices can still be increased every year. And what that will result in is higher medication costs and increased premiums, which we want to avoid. The other elements.
Please wrap it up.
Okay.
You're 4 minutes over your 2 minutes. So.
Okay. We're in support of this initiative, and we'll do anything we can to help work it forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacob Thompson. I'm the Regional Director of Pharmacy Operations and Compliance for Providence Health and Services, and I'm here today to testify in favor of a comprehensive solution for addressing the unsustainable rising cost of pharmaceuticals. As a provider and payer, Providence experiences this challenge twofold. We see this problem from multiple points of view. I'd like to spend a little time about both of those. We see our patients struggle to afford life-saving medications, including those that have been around for years, but now as generics, are experiencing cost increases that have no rational explanation other than an oligopoly-like nature of our drug market. Our hospitals and clinics face uncontrollable costs and rising drug prices delivered through the medical benefit. These increases impact the rates we charge payers, including our own health plan. In the last few years, drug costs have risen at 4 times the rate of revenue inflation. New specialty drugs are significant drivers to this increased cost, but so too are generic drugs, as Representative Nose already highlighted. For a couple other examples, nitroprusside, an injectable drug used to lower blood pressure, increased 268% over 2 years. Isoproterenol, an injectable drug used in heart failure, increased 719% over 2 years. These are drugs that have been on the market for quite some time, but the increases are not expected result of market natural forces. Instead, they are what we see in a wide range of drugs in what has become a sheltered and oligopolistic market. And then as a payer at Providence, we see the rising prices of pharmaceutical drugs, whether in the commercial, Medicaid, or and Medicare market, as having a major impact on our rates. Pharmaceutical costs are growing faster than every other aspect of healthcare, and specialty drugs are the primary factor in that growth rate. These costs have real impacts on state budgets, too. In the last 2 years for our Medicaid population, costs have grown at 9.9%, while drug costs grew 23%. When costs increase in a capitated budget, it means reductions in services elsewhere. House Bill 2387 and the corresponding amendments are a comprehensive approach to addressing this problem. For years, the healthcare community has taken a one-off approach to addressing drug prices, pitting different entities against each other. Drug companies versus consumers versus insurance versus providers. It is no longer productive to attempt to address a multifaceted problem with an approach that doesn't address all sides of the problem. Providence believes it is important that we improve access to the most cost-effective and safe medication for our patients.
Time to wrap it up.
We want our patients to take these drugs when prescribed and be able to afford to do so. But we cannot ignore the fact that reducing cost to consumers through their insurance benefit plan will substantially increase their insurance rates and thus reduce access to insurance.
Thank you.
So we support this bill with amendments and appreciate the work being done. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please. Introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, and members of the committee, thank you for the honor and the opportunity to present testimony on Oregon's budget in support of House Bill 2387. My name is Diane Solomon. I'm a doctorally prepared nurse and member of ONA, representing registered nurses and nurse practitioners in healthcare settings across the state. I've been privileged to practice as a psychiatric nurse practitioner and certified nurse midwife in rural, tribal, and urban Oregon for over 30 years. As a writer, I was also honored to author Senator Mark Hatfield's memoir with him. I'm here today representing ONA. We are committed to ensuring Oregon addresses the rapidly increasing prescription drug costs that impede delivery of successful, timely, affordable patient care. Prescription prices are one of the fastest growing drivers of health care, more than doubling over the past several years, as we've heard. Oregon patients cannot keep paying the price, either through pharmacy dollars personally or rising insurance premiums. Oregon employers cannot keep paying the price by slashing benefits, and the state budget cannot keep paying the price either. We require a sustainable solution. In Oregon, we're proud and nationally championed for successfully retrenching health care via the triple aim: improved outcomes, improved patient-centered care, and decreased costs. As part of that goal, we aim to keep the public health care growth rate at 3.4% annually. But growing drug costs threaten every public and private health care budget in the state. Unaffordable, skyrocketing prescription prices impact us all, including myself. My husband and I have four children, one whom is on the autism spectrum. He, like most children with autism, struggles to sleep. Without medication, he's up at all hours, unable to learn, be socialized, and miserably sleep deprived. Last year, we were forced to pay $1,200 for a simple, non-specialty, non-narcotic sleep medication that private insurance refused to pay. Meanwhile, consumers in both private and OHP CCO markets are forced to pay higher co-pays, cost shares, and premiums.
Please wrap it up.
Okay. In my own practice, I specialize in women's mental health. When mothers suffer depression, anxiety, or other mental health disorders, known and catastrophic downstream effects ensue. Children of these mothers suffer psychiatric diagnoses, impaired cognitive, social, and academic functioning, and often...
I'm really sorry to be rude, we have three pages of people who like to testify today. I'd like to maximize their ability to do so.
Okay. We support this bill, and we simply cannot afford astronomical downstream health care consequences tomorrow while we stand by today.
Thank you. Representative Hack?
Thank you, Chair. My question is to the two gentlemen. Can you absolutely guarantee to us that we can take back to our constituents that without a doubt premiums will be lower and that there will be more access to prescription drugs at a lower price, with exactly what she's saying right there, to our constituents, without a doubt, no question, if this bill were to pass, that that would happen, that you can guarantee that to our constituents?
Chair Greenlee and President Hack, there are no guarantees like that. This bill is really trying to get at the root cause, which is a huge inflationary aspect. It's not to lower costs, it's to try to cap the rate of growth that we're seeing. All healthcare costs increase. It's just a pernicious fact that we've seen for the last decade that pharmacy costs are increasing at a rate faster than anything else. And because prescription drugs are a primary form of treatment in medical practice today, it hits everyone's pocketbook really hard.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
The absolute intention of this is to provide more opportunity for people, exactly like she is saying, to have access to, and when they come into NOSA's office and our office and they dump it on the table, and we've all experienced it, that's exactly why we're here. And if we cannot guarantee that, we can't risk exactly what Representative Buehler said, that folks would be possibly denied access to the best and the brightest and the greatest innovation and still not give them access to the medications that they so desperately need and the reduced premiums and at a cost that's affordable to them. That absolutely just is so disheartening. It's exactly why we're here to do, and he spent 18 months working so hard to do. So thank you, and I'm good.
Folks from DCBS to talk about the rate setting process, and we'll perhaps have that time to make sure. The issue is, do these price reductions get carried through in the rate process? We can talk about that one. Mr. Ambula?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlake. I'm really glad to hear the Providence and Mode representative voice or support for price caps, considering yours have gone up double digits the last several years. I'm just considering your enthusiasm for price caps. Would you be willing to tie your rate increases to a foreign price cap, like you're requiring pharmaceuticals to do? Specifically to the rate of increase in the 35 members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Chair Greenlake and Representative Biller, the rate setting process is a fully vetted process that is controlled through DBCS, and it's one that we have been participating in for years, and we're very comfortable with that process.
That's not what I asked you. I asked you if you would be willing to tie it to a foreign price cap.
I understand, sir. The short answer is we will play by the rules that DBCS sets for us.
That's a no. Thank you.
The camera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, if I may. I was concerned about whether there was a windfall and what would happen with this change, substantial savings, and I sent emails to the major carriers in the area. I had one person come to visit and say they couldn't tell. The others never responded, and I just thought that ought to be on the record.
Would you call the next panel, please?
Yes.
We might stipulate that insurance carriers will support this bill and the pharmaceutical industry will oppose it. Let's see if we get some more imagination into that.
Sandra Shotwell, Ryan Dunlop, and Brian Martin.
We're going to be alternating pro and con panel. Sort of.
Chair Greenlake and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today. It's an important bill, and I represent an important problem that you're addressing, and it is a complicated one. The president is right. Thank you for your attention to it. I want to give you
Can you introduce yourself, please?
Forgive me.
Your name?
Sandra Shotwell.
Thank you.
Thanks. I forgot that. I'm with a small company that's a spin-out from Portland State University, Design Medics. So we develop drugs for infectious disease, and our focus is overcoming drug resistance. Drug resistance is projected to kill more people by 2050 than cancer. So diseases are finding their way around drugs. The drugs that we have are starting to not work for certain diseases. Our lead drug is for malaria, and we are about to get it to the clinic. We've received support from the state through Portland State University, developed some initial exploratory work. We've been building on that for 9 years. We've gotten support from the signature research centers, ONAMI and OTRADI. We've had support from the University Venture Development Fund. We've had a lot of support from the state, and when I read this bill, I thought, let me say two other things. We worked very hard to find a manufacturer in Oregon for our drug for the clinical trials we hope to start at the end of this year. And we found a small company in Eugene that could do that. And now we're working very hard to find someone to put the drug in capsules. And we found a company in Bend that can do that for us. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, so we've had all this wind at our back, and now it's in our face. We've worked hard from the beginning to make this something that's inexpensive and that's affordable. A malaria drug cannot be expensive. But we can only take this product so far. The next step will be a company, a pharmaceutical company, that has the capability to run the very expensive and very complicated clinical trials. We're working with the NIH for the phase one clinical trials, but they can only help us basically through that step. So we have had a venture investment in this, not venture, local angels who have supported us. They've given us about $3 million. We've brought into the state.
About this bill?
I do. And sorry, have I not made that clear? I haven't. I am concerned that it will stifle innovation. We are asked when people invest in us, when we applied for these grants, we've brought $10 million in grants in. The government has asked us to give them a plan, a commercialization plan. Can we actually get a product to market? It is a capitalist economy in which we function. Even the federal government and the state agencies that have given us grant support have asked us to demonstrate that we'll be able to find a partner who will be able to make money by taking this to the market. And so I am concerned that this bill will stifle innovation, that it would make it harder for companies like ours in Oregon who've hired PSU students.
I've heard it. What is there in this bill that, I mean,
so a small
you strike a rich, you get a product, you sell it in Sweden for $89,000 a treatment, and that's your limit on your price in Oregon. How does that stifle anything in this bill?
Chair Greenlee and members of the committee, my concern is that I'm asked when I ask investors to help us with the funds to move a program forward, that they say to me, what about government policies? What about things like price caps? So it actually comes up when we go to look for investment. And we're just the early stage of a drug development project. Did
okay.
you have?
Yeah, next, please.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Noss, members of the committee. Thanks for hearing me today. It's not the first time that I've made my points on the subject. My name is Ryan Dunlap. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Bioscience Association, and I'm the CFO of a company called MolecularMD, a diagnostic company that helps support the development of personalized medicine for oncology. My comments, I'll be brief. I'm going to direct my comments to very specific issues, and it's the ones we're talking about here from the perspective of someone who's in finance, who's had to raise money for companies, and control financial risk. I want to address the stifling of innovation, and I'm going to get very basic and why this will stifle innovation. It's because investment decisions, both in the markets from VCs, from investment banks, and from pharmaceutical companies when they're looking to invest in either their own products or bring on companies, is based on the relationship between risk and reward. That's a very balanced relationship, and the capital markets are very efficient in that regard. If you do anything to regulate or cap or otherwise limit the reward side without doing anything to the risk side, you do create an imbalance which drives investment away. That's a fact. So
what's the fact?
The fact is that
this bill that will stifle
the analysts on Wall Street, the investment banks will look at this as a price cap, something that restricts the reward. They still have the same risks, and I don't have time to go into all the risks of drug development here.
Well, you
in
don't
this
need
form.
To go into all the risks of drug development. What you do need to explain is how this bill in any way will affect your ability to...
We're in a capitalist system, and you're limiting it and tying it to other economies that are not in a capitalist system.
For God's sakes, you guys have been rewarded by the government forever. What's this notion about a capitalist system?
Well, that's the system we live in. So let me bring up another point in research and development and all the money that's been invested, because it's not, I don't recall any of my companies being helped by the government with all due respect, Chairman Greenlee.
You don't?
I don't.
You serious? Don't think that NIH research has helped?
I've never
companies?
Received an NIH grant for any of the companies that I've worked
then
with.
And that's not the point. The point is the basic research has been done by NIH that's handed you an example on the PSU spinoff.
Sure.
It's handed you millions and millions in background research.
Basic research and investment in our research institutions does not translate into patient benefit. Until that drug, until it gets approved by the FDA and a company goes through that long, arduous, expensive process, it does not. That's my point. I'd like to make a quick point on the transparency piece, too, and I'm not arguing against transparency, but I am a CPA who spent a lot of time financial reporting. I get the concept, but I don't think this is practicable. The bill does not provide a framework around which you would base this financial reporting. A lot of questions that a CPA would ask are not answered. How do you deal with overhead allocations? What about pooled R&D efforts? What about all the drug programs that failed? You have to kiss a lot of frogs in this business to get to that one breakthrough treatment. I'll also say that this can't be audited. I mean, and I don't know what the information will be used for. I think this information would wind up going into a file, and it would never result in any meaningful decision making. You're asking people to explain their margins and their long-term ROI, but there's nothing in this bill that says that they're supposed to also report the risk that translates into that ROI.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan, you're doing a good job. I remember you explained this. You're explaining it again very well. And I understand your criticisms of some of the transparency pieces. Is there something that we can do that would explain why 100 drugs that have been on the market for a long period of time, 4 years, have all gone up in price 71% or greater? Like, if there's a way to have transparency around helping us understand why that's going on, I'd be open to that as an amendment.
And I appreciate that, and I do appreciate the hard work and the complexity of the issue. When we talk about these high-profile cases, they're always generics that have been off patent for a long
Brands
time.
Brands, too, in that list.
But this bill doesn't distinguish between on-patent and off-patent. When I'm talking about efficient economic systems, I'm talking about the capital system. I'm not talking about the consumer markets. There are inefficiencies there that prevent competition that would normally, in a free market system, drive the price back down.
Okay.
Could you wrap up, please?
I am not in favor of this bill, and thank you so much.
That's a good one. And for the insurance industry, if you'd say we are in favor of this bill and wrap it up, that would be helpful, too. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Just a quick follow-up, and also to Rob Nose for a lot of work on this bill and communication with me on it. I appreciate that. If we did look at an amendment that separated out the on-patent, off-patent, or a time frame within that, and it would push back a little bit, we did pass a bill that allows access on a limited basis for the right to try for some of these pharmaceuticals as they go through their stages to help certain people in limited cases. But if we were able to do some sort of amendment that separated so we could kind of address the issue separately from advanced research to the pharma bro kind of concept of buying up a patent and taking a generic drug and running it through the roof, you know, whether that's just a small antibiotic that they can drive the price up, or, you know, something to treat asthma, things that we've seen happen. Would that be helpful, and would that stifle research at all?
I think it would be helpful. I don't think that would be addressing the whole problem of the inefficient consumer market. I think there are a lot of barriers to entry that go beyond that, but I do think it would be helpful, and it certainly would prevent some of that stifling, because investors would still have an opportunity to make the required return based on the risk while the drug's on patent. I'll quickly mention that time frame is getting shorter and shorter as these drug programs get more lengthy, as the treatments are more personalized and harder to enroll. It's a complex problem, but I do think that would be a good start.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Dr. Brian Martin. I'm a physician and computer scientist. I'm the former director of medical informatics for GE Healthcare, a company with 14... Oh,
just
closer?
Back a little farther.
Yeah. Oh,
you don't...
There. Okay, sorry about that.
No worries.
Did you catch that part?
Yes.
I hope. Okay. So the company I worked for had $14 billion in international healthcare sales.
Wow.
And I was their site leader for Oregon, which meant I had their technology staff under my purview. We had 180 employees here when I started. And then I was told we would have to lay off and get rid of our employees because they were shifting our employees to the work of our employees to Bangalore, India. So as of today, that site, which had 180 tech employees, is now closed. There are no more tech employees here from GE Healthcare. The other part of my background that's relevant, I was a director of prevention and control research for the Cancer Research Center of Hawaii and the past chair of the Mental Health Association of Hawaii. I've had a longstanding active role in healthcare policy nationally. I was part of the group that helped to pass the Disadvantaged Minority Healthcare Act of 1990. So I have a longstanding interest in how people access healthcare, how to make sure they get what's necessary to keep them healthy. I can tell you that Medicare last year spent over $600 billion in healthcare in this country. And of that, more than $300 billion was spent on only 5% of the population. Okay? And we know that if we could put in place a number of preventive health initiatives, chronic disease management, we could reduce that spend. Drug spend was only about 15% of that $250 billion. I mean, the big change is going to be to better manage the health care. And so when I left GE Healthcare to do my startup, I run a startup now called Recentia Health. Our focus was to take electronic medical records from different vendors, aggregate them, and use artificial intelligence to provide advice to physicians on how to comply or adhere to Medicare, Medicaid, and other insurance guidelines to help them better manage their patients' health care. And frankly, to help keep doctors in business. I know a lot of physicians who are leaving the practice because of the overburdensome regulations out there. But that's our focus. And our revenue model is based on providing pharma with information on which orphan diseases they can focus on to do their drug development with. When you have patients that represent maybe 10,000 patients across the population, that's a high-risk investment for pharma. When you've got, 30 million patients or 50 million, that's not so bad. But when you've got such a small set of patients, it's difficult to make the investment decision. Now, Representative Knotts, I really appreciate the way you presented the data. I agree with that, the way you presented it. And you've asked about recommendations, so I'm going to put myself out a bit. Coming from the preventive health model of disease management, if you really want to get people to access health care, you're going to do something that insurance companies don't like. You'll eliminate deductibles. You reduce co-pays to reasonable levels that working-class families can afford. You'll force PBMs, pharmaceutical benefit managers, to pass on the rebates they get directly to consumers.
Are you supporting this bill? Or opposed?
I'm opposed to the bill.
It sounded like you were supporting it when you're talking
about it. It may sound like it. I think it's a laudable goal, Chairman Greenlake, a laudable goal to ensure that patients have access to health care. The mechanism, though, is very burdensome to small companies like myself, to startups. The challenge I face, we're doing an economic development play. We're trying to get more jobs for technology people here in Oregon through my company. The challenge I face is that when I go out to raise capital for my company, I can't do that here in Oregon. I go to Silicon Valley. I have been told point blank that if you want to raise capital from us, you have to agree to relocate to San Francisco or to New York.
That's under the current system. This bill is
under the current system. We've been arguing that we can run our company here. What this will do is overburdensome, we call it overburdensome regulations, will put one more arrow in the quiver of the venture capitalists in the Bay Area to say, you really shouldn't have your company in Oregon. And we've been struggling to keep it here and to keep our economic development here. And that's the main reason I'm against it. It gives another arrow that VCs outside of Oregon can shoot at us and say we shouldn't be investing in Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could you call the next panel, please?
Brian DeLashmet, Marcy Slater, and Jared Mason Gear.
For the record, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashmet. I reside in South Salem. For 37 years, I represented clients in healthcare here in Oregon, including the Oregon Nurses Association.
Thank you.
However, I'm here to tell you my personal story. In 2014, out of nowhere, I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. It's a somewhat rare blood disease. Had a kidney stone, went to the hospital, didn't even know I was ill. Was told I had 95% cancerous blood and had days potentially to live. After heavy doses of chemotherapy and treatment, I was stabilized. 6 months later, I was up at OHSU and given a stem cell transplant. With that history, that brings me to the central focus testimony. Shortly after the transplant, I was on approximately 8 drugs. I'm down to 5 drugs now. Let me focus on 2 drugs. This prescription right here is $17,000. This pill right here, same pill, $608 every single day. That's the rest of my life. In addition, I have a injection in my stomach of another drug every 2 weeks, approximately another $3,000. That does not include the administration of the drug itself, doctor's visits, the nurse's time, and so forth. Do the math. Those 2 drugs are approximately $23,000 a month. That's the new normal for people with incurable cancer like I have. While I'm covered by Medicare and have a very good supplemental insurance, and I can handle the cost, the additional cost, it's hundreds up to $1,000 a month for me. But there are a lot of people that can't do that. I see them every day when I go in to get my chemotherapy.
Take good care of that pill.
Pardon?
Don't drop it.
Take good care of that pill.
Yeah, I better make sure I put it back away. Let me mention, and I'll close, some of the programs that deal with extreme costs. Many of these programs are administered by drug companies or nonprofits that attempt to help with the cost of these expensive drugs. And I applaud both the nonprofits and the drug companies for these kinds of programs that help some folks in a situation like myself. But in many times, the cap for income is too high, or too low, excuse me, in this case, that they don't qualify. With that, I'll close. Again, I'm happy to be here, and I would answer any questions. It's good to see old friends, Oregon Nurses Association, and a number of folks that I dealt with for 37 years in the building, and thank you again.
It's nice to see you back. I'm sorry you're having a serious problem. That's next, please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for letting me share my story today. My name is Marcy Slater. I am in support of House Bill 2387. I am a patient and a consumer. I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1994 and have been taking the injectable medication Copaxone since 2000. This is a therapy, not a cure. My quality of life depends on this medication, and that I'm able, and because of it, I am able to walk without a cane, have energy for my life, and actually speak to you today. I am completely dependent on this medication. Given its high cost, is frankly quite frightening. In 1995, I had to retire from work because I was too sick to continue, and we've been on single-income household ever since. When I first started taking Copaxone in 2000, it cost $700 a month. Today, it costs $7,000 a month. That is a 1,000% increase. The rate of inflation over the same period is 44%, which would make Copaxone $1,010 today per month. This is not a new drug. It's been on the market for years, since the mid-90s. I had no idea why this is increasing to that rate. My physician doesn't know either. The actual drug has not changed in all the time that it's been on the market in any way. This is the last month that I will have insurance through my husband's coverage, and that has made it somewhat affordable. Now we will be to not be able to pay for this expensive medication for several years. My husband was unemployed. We lost our COBRA coverage, and the consequential financial burden nearly bankrupted us. Now we are moving into a new situation. My husband is about to retire, and we fortunately, because of the ACA Act and pre-existing condition clause, I will be able to get Medicare Advantage. I will pay about $9,000 a year out of pocket with that coverage, and that's just my copay and premium. The root cause of that medication cost too high for me and for everyone who needs it, no matter what kind of coverage they have. It is not enough for drug companies to offer grants and coupons to patients to hide the true cost of the drug. The whole thing is just outrageous. And now there is a generic in place of Copaxone because the daily dosing went off patent. The drug company that makes Copaxone, which is Teva Corporation, has a new product that is the same exact medication. It's just being delivered twice a week injection instead of daily injection. I have tried both the generic and the new dosing. I cannot tolerate either one. It immediately throws me into a flare-up, and I'm no longer to function. Without any of the medication, I immediately have cognitive issues, and my gait is affected. I get confused easily. Both alternatives are also very expensive, so I have to stay on Copaxone.
Please wrap up.
Yeah, I will. The answer is pretty clear. If we couldn't get this medication, I would be in a nursing home being cared for by other people, which at a much greater expense to the state. There is no justification for the 1,000% price increase for this drug. I think it is time for drug companies to be held accountable for their high prices. There needs to be much more transparency in the system, and patients and consumers like myself who count on these medicines should have some relief. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. I'm Jared Mason, here representing the Oregon Education Association and our 40.
Sorry, I didn't hear what you just said.
Jared Mason, here for the record, representing the Oregon Education Association and our 44,000 educators around the state, serving 600,000 K-12 students and 70,000 community college students statewide. I know time is short, so I'll focus, I think, on just two points that I think are a little bit different vantage point than many of the others today have or will share. One is the on behalf of the students, our members are advocates for the students that they serve. We represent, in addition to classroom teachers, school nurses, school counselors, other personnel that are seeing a dramatic rise in the number of students that are arriving to school with really severe, in some cases potentially deadly, mostly food allergies, and seeing the toll that that's taken on their families as they are increasingly having to shell out for very expensive prescription drugs, EpiPens, and so forth. From the vantage point of our members are in the OEB system where they get their health care insurance. OEB covers between our members of county government and their families, about 150,000 Oregonians. They have seen dramatic increases in out-of-pocket costs, both for health care and for their insurance itself. Largely as a result of increased pharmaceutical costs. We know that pharmaceutical costs have dramatically outpaced normal health care costs. PEB system is 34% increase just in the last 2 years. Pharmaceutical costs, OEB is similar. And just to sort of put a face on all of this, I received an email from one of our members yesterday evening who gave me permission to share his story. His name is Scott Wagner. He's a diesel tech instructor at Blue Mountain Community College out in Pendleton. Scott and his wife have lived an extraordinarily conservative financial lifestyle, a frugal lifestyle. They have mortgage debt. Up until recently, they've had mortgage debt and nothing else. They now pay $10,000 a year. Scott is undergoing chemotherapy for cancer. Between the hospital costs and pharmaceutical costs, he's paying $10,000 a year trying to dig his way out of debt. He couldn't come down today because he's going back into chemotherapy on Monday, or he would have come to share his story himself. But these are the types of people that I think are counting on the legislature to take action, and I hope you will do that this session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we call the next panel, please?
Tara Ryan, Jim Gardner, and Denise McCarty.
Go for it, Tara.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Nose, and members of the Health Committee, my name is Tara Ryan. I represent the pharmaceutical industry, and it will come as no surprise to any of you that we oppose 2387. However, I think in the time that I've been allocated, I won't be able to address most of the things I heard today. I want to click on a few things. And Representative Nose, we appreciate you including us. I'm disheartened to hear that you felt that we didn't offer any viable ideas. I will say that following the introduction of language that put a price cap in place, the ability for us to negotiate on something like a price cap sort of went away. Okay. We have a lot of other ways that we think that we can address pricing. I want to say that pricing, pharmaceutical pricing, is a federal issue. And there are a lot of things that have to be done at the federal level in order for us to engage in meaningful ways to help reduce pricing. On the other side, access to medicines is something that happens in a way that's regulated primarily at the state level through insurance benefit design, PBMs, and things like that. Trying to focus a bill entirely on addressing the pharmaceutical industry without looking at the supply chain and the other stakeholders that play a role in pricing and the development of benefit design that is actually what that actually dictate how patients pay for their medicine leaves a big gap in how we have to look at this process. I just want to hit on a couple of things quickly, just to sort of set some of the record straight and talk about some of the things that I heard. Certainly, I listen to the stories of the patients who come to the table at these hearings, and I go to many of these hearings around the country. It's devastating to hear that people are suffering from disease. In the United States today, there should be no person that can't afford their health care. There should be no person who's worrying about how to afford their health care. But what we're seeing recently is that health care is becoming more expensive. And what's actually happening is that costs that used to be covered by the insurance industry are now being shifted onto patients. Patients are paying more in deductibles, they're paying more in premiums, and they're paying more in their out-of-pocket costs. In Oregon alone, just looking at your silver plans, you've got about the highest co-insurance in the specialty tiers of any state in the country. When we compared it to Washington, Nevada, California, you've got some of the highest maximum out-of-pocket costs. If you look at just what this bill does, it sets a payment back to insurers based on the copay cap that's created in the bill, which other states have passed copay caps without putting price controls in place, and they're now tracking to see what the impact of that would be on benefit design and on patients and stuff. So plans can actually do that without price controls in place. If you look at the copay cap and the maximum out-of-pocket cap, Oregon has one of the highest maximum out-of-pocket caps. In your non-standardized plans, it's about $500 higher than the national average. You set a high maximum out-of-pocket cap and a low copay cap, that difference is what gets paid back to the insurers. They're incentivized to keep that maximum out-of-pocket cap high. They're incentivized to keep that copay cap low. It benefits them. All of that money goes back to them. This is an industry that's got a lot of protections in place versus the industry, all the companies around the country right now that are doing research and development to bring new life-saving drugs to market. In Oregon alone, you have 1 in 12 adults who have cancer. You have 300,000 people who are suffering from diabetes, and you have 1.7 million people in this state who are suffering from chronic disease. I will testify that chronic disease is the largest cost driver in healthcare today. It's growing faster than any other aspect of healthcare. You heard from a few of the people who have already testified. If we don't attack chronic disease, we are not going to be able to sustain the system that we have. The best way to deal with chronic disease is to make sure people are adherent to their medicines. You had people here today who are suffering from terrible illness. Those people would not be alive today without medicines. The fact that their medicines are not affordable or the fact that their insurance isn't covering their care, that's the issue that we have to be addressing. Looking at how much goes into research and development, looking at all of the, you know, reporting requirements, 3.4% price increases. Let's just talk about that for a second. Average wholesale price, which is the basis that's set in this bill, is not a price that manufacturers set. It's set by regulatory pricing compendia. It is a price that is the highest negotiating price between PBMs and pharmacies. It's not a price that we deal with. So why that pricing is a standard that's being used, I don't know. average wholesale acquisition cost, or the WAC price, the list price. That's the pricing that we have seen in a lot of other states. That's the list price. That's the price that the pharmaceutical manufacturer set as sort of the initial price that starts the negotiations with pharmacy benefit managers. If you take drugs like insulin and some of these drugs that you've probably been hearing about in your discussions over the past 18 months, we've seen those WAC prices go up. But the net price has stayed the same. What's happening is there are three PBMs in the country that control 75 to 80% of every prescription written in this country. Three PBMs. That is an enormous amount of leveraging power. So what happens is a pharmaceutical company comes to the table. They've got this drug that they want introduced. And they say, we want it to come to market at this price. The PBMs say, that's not high enough. We need it to go higher. Net price goes up. List price goes up, net price goes down. Let me just read a statistic for you. IMS Health found that net prices for brand medicines, which factor in all the discounts and rebates that our manufacturers pay, increased just 2.8% in 2015, 2.8%. That's a five-year low. Invoice prices, the list prices that I'm talking about, which don't account for the rebates, they grew by 12.4%. That's a big gap. Why are the list prices going up so much when the net price, after our companies are paying rebates, is at 2.8%? The reason that's happening is you've got all these other participants in the supply chain, and nobody's looking at that. Nobody's looking at how that plays out in this whole thing. This bill does not address that issue. Our manufacturers are taking. Say it again, please.
We do have a bill to begin to address that issue.
This bill doesn't necessarily help that. So you were asking earlier about how does this impact access in the state of Oregon to patients. I think Representative Bueller said it could potentially result in inability to access medicine, which is the exact opposite of what we want to do. We want people to get preventive medicines. We want people to get medicines to treat their disease. By all means, if there are cures coming to market, hepatitis C, we want patients to access those. There are so many different complex pricing schemes in place in the United States. Different things are tied to different sales. Sales at the commercial market are tied to best price in Medicaid. To participate in Medicaid, you have to give VA pricing and TRICARE pricing. There are a lot of different convoluted, complex, overlapping systems in place.
Can you wrap up, please?
If you put something like this in place, you're triggering other pricing schemes that create an enormous disincentive for manufacturers to continue and develop medicines. I'm going to use Korea. It's an OECD country. It's a price control country, and it also serves as a reference price for a lot of other OECD countries. Korea has a pharmaceutical company there. They brought a new drug to market in 2015. They did not launch their own product in their own country because they knew that by doing so, it would impact their ability to sell that drug outside of Korea at prices that were not sustainable for them. So this bill will not only impact Oregon, it will impact the United States, and it could impact global access to medicine. This is an issue that should be dealt with at the federal level, and then we should look at the supply chain issues that can be handled in the state of Oregon.
I have to say, that's not an argument against it. In my mind, it would be an argument for it. If we could lead the way to mediating prices in the country, that would be great. Jim, it's you.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Pharma, and I wanted to just say at first I was privileged to serve on the work group with Representative Nose, and I think despite the policy disagreements that manifested themselves at the end of the day, I think all of us worked in great good faith to try to come up with evidence-based solutions to issues that have presented themselves. And I want to focus on evidence-based solutions just for a moment and draw your attention to a statistic that was presented previously to this committee about a week ago by the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation when they looked at drivers of healthcare costs, and they looked specifically at the commercial population, commercial lives, which is really what this bill is focused on, individual and small group market. And what they found was that the price index for Oregon compared with five comparison regions was 17% above average. That's pretty high, 17% above average. But then they drilled down into the specifics, and you'll recall this, I think, Mr. Chair, that while the high of was 27% above average for inpatient hospital, it was 2% below average, a statistic that frankly surprised me a little bit, 2% below average for pharmacy services, which includes acquisition as well as the service delivery, probably reflecting aggressive formulary management, prior authorization, et cetera, for those particular lives. But that's the statistic we're dealing with. And then how does that fit in? I think it shows what the targets ought to be in terms of where we direct our efforts. I want to talk just briefly about the DCBS rate setting process. And I think you'll hear some more discussion about that in a moment. Unlike your bill, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2116, there is no statutory mandate in this bill for a pass-through, 100% pass-through of the benefit to consumers. It will be basically rolled into the rate-setting process, essentially as a general fund resource for the insurer. And then what happens in that process is that the regulator will look at the risk profile of the insurer, the reserves, actuarial trends, et cetera, including that 27% overage in terms of inpatient hospital. All of that will be taken into account in the rate-making process. No assurance whatsoever that there will be a pass-through to the patients. In fact, what the Q Corp study suggests is that there may well be a cross subsidization into inpatient hospital. I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Good morning,
and
Chair Greenlee.
I want to thank you for your work on that task force as well. I think it was really appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Nose, and Vice Chair Hayden, and esteemed members. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Denise McCarty. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Bioscience Association. And we're here in opposition to HB 2387. But first, I wanted to take a moment to say thank you. Thank you for your investment in the life sciences sector and bioscience in our state. Oregon invested in OHSU Knight Cancer Institute, which enabled OHSU to meet the funding challenge and to create a $1 billion fund for cancer care and research. You also invested in the Oregon Bioscience Incubator, which is a signature research center, which is home to 17 bioscience companies today. And in this biennium alone, those companies captured $15 million in federal funding, engaged in 9 corporate and pharma partnerships, created and retained 120 jobs, raised $50 million in private angel and venture capital funding. And it's also worth noting that they consumed over 60 cases of wine at the happy hour that they have monthly. I also wanted to bring to your
Oregon
attention.
Wine, I hope.
Oregon wine. In fact, the Oregon Wine Group Trade Association is in their building, I think. So it's also worth noting that the OBI was born out of the original investment from the Governor's Strategic Reserve. So again, thank you for your investment. While I have a captive audience, I wanted to give you an opportunity to learn about the new fourth economic independent impact study that Bioscience released this year. Our sector continues to have steady and significant growth. Our total economic activity attributed to the bioscience industry is estimated at $10.3 billion, including over 46,000 jobs and $340 million in tax and revenue for the state and local government.
Isn't capitalism great?
I'm sorry?
I say, isn't capitalism great?
Yes.
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 Yes. Yes.
Your alternative?
Yeah.
The alternative is all the state money that's going into that.
Well, I can also say that those individual companies are diverse in their geographic reach, sir, and they are our demographic and our workforce is diverse. 49% of bioscience companies reside outside of the Portland area, and almost every single county in the state is home to a bioscience company. Our private bioscience industry average wage is $74,000 a year, and it's 50% greater than the statewide average for private sector employment. And with $3.7 billion in exports, Our industry, bioscience and life sciences, brings new money to the state, and we're a growing economic sector. You heard from three of our companies today, and we stand again in opposition to HB 2387. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I just want to point out, I don't know if it's on all of us here or not, I'm sure they're not speaking on behalf of your association, but there is a bioscience company that wrote to me and said they don't think this approach is going to put them out of business, and they think that something needs to be done in the drug space. Hopefully that will get posted on all of us.
Mr. Kahneman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions from Mr. Gardner. One is there a precedent for this kind of a bill?
Mr. Chair,
your history goes back a long
yeah,
time, and I just thought, well, that's your commentary.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, I almost call you Senator Kenemer because that was when we were first
got
to
go back too.
No, it's in the United States. I believe this would be a unique approach.
Let me ask a second question. I'm intrigued. I just learned yesterday that apparently the patient groups are introducing a series of bills in the Senate. And I'm not understanding that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, what I think that the advocacy groups foresaw that some controversy would surround this particular bill and have chosen to extract elements from it, plan transparency, for instance, Senate Bill 272, other elements in other bills, and present them as independent ideas.
To what extent are those groups financed by pharmacy?
Mr. Chair, I am really not aware of the answer to that question. I think it's ACS CAN, for instance. I think there may be some grants, some C3 type grants to them, but I think it's a pretty minor part of their funding profile. That's my impression.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I've definitely made it known how I feel about the PBM, so I appreciate you bringing that up because I think that they are a huge culprit in the pharmaceutical issue that we're having. But one thing that you did bring up that I'm just curious about because I don't think we've said a whole lot about it and I'm wanting to understand a little bit more is the best price issue, the law with the Medicaid, and what effect that could potentially have on you briefly touched, and I don't want to take a whole lot of time, but I'm just trying to understand the impact that could possibly have, because that's not my world.
Yeah, and I'll be totally honest, I'm not entirely sure how that would play out, but I will explain that best price is based on the lowest commercial sale of a drug. So it takes one sale at a certain price to reset best price across the country. Medicaid programs get best price. They also have inflationary penalties, and they can protect against price increases during the course of the year. It was not until 2017 that they could protect against generic price increases, but before that, they could protect against brand manufacturer price increases. So the Medicaid program gets the best price that's commercially available based on one sale, and then they have these price protections in place also.
Can I have just one follow-up really quick? Could that then potentially even be more of a disincentive?
Absolutely.
For a drug company to say we're going to give you the best and the greatest, I'm just thinking of my constituents. If there's a drug out there that can treat something that I just want to make sure they have the best. So I'm just curious if that, and who knows? But I mean, I just.
So the question is, would it trigger a Medicaid best price? Would this sort of proposal trigger a Medicaid best price based on the sale here? One sale at a price that's. I mean, if you take a drug that's got an AWP of $10,000, which is what this bill is based on, and a foreign pricing, the highest foreign price is $7,000, $3,000 gets paid back to the insurer. Then you look at the $6,800 maximum out-of-pocket cap and the $100 copay cap, and that's $6,700. So on a drug that's $10,000 AWP, that's $9,700 that's getting paid back to the insurers by the manufacturers, in addition to the already contracted rebates or discounts that manufacturers have to pay. So actually, insurers are making money in many cases on the drug. So if that resets Medicaid best price, I mean, you can imagine how that plays out. I'm not positive that it does. That's obviously something that the industry is looking into.
But when we talk about a windfall too, you know, you're picking insurers as the winners here over research and developing manufacturers who are coming up with cures for diseases as recently as 2014 for hepatitis C, which is one of the most devastating diseases in the country.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I got to just interject here.
Yeah. Why don't you, and then we'll move on to the next
I think
panel.
The discussion that Tara Ryan is talking about with regard to Medicaid best price, you know, she's on to something. She's not making that up. That's a legitimate issue that we ought to think about, and there's probably ways that we could figure out how to deal with that if this becomes a real thing that we're going to do. What I would appreciate, though, is it's hard. I'm not sympathetic when you say we're trying to do a windfall for the insurance industry when, again, go to the look on OLUS, you have 100 drugs, all went up in price, generic and brand, all right, for no apparent reason that we can understand. Now, that does not feel like capitalism to me.
Yeah.
Just saying.
There are states, though, that are addressing price increases that are above what people consider to be something that is sort of in the ordinary course of price increases. Talking about a 3.4% increase means that the state of Oregon would be collecting data basically on maybe every – there are probably almost 3,000 drugs that have had a price increase of more than 10% in a year. So this number is significantly lower. You can imagine the sort of reporting that that would be required under this. No. Other states are looking at thresholds that are significantly higher to address the outliers, the Daraprims of the world. We're talking about the pharma bro guy. You shouldn't have price increases of 2,000%. You know, but if you get to the threshold of 100%, are you capturing drugs that are actually going to impact premiums? Are you and benefit design? I mean, you don't want to do a fishing expedition to capture all of it. You want to figure out what's driving changes in benefit design, what's driving increased cost.
I think we need to move on to the next panel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would you call the next panel?
Tyler Shipman, Sean Parkman, and Dan Torres.
We have how many more people?
After this, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people. We had a total of 8.
All right. If you would please hurry, I would like to give everybody a chance.
Sean Parkman? Okay. Tyler Shipman is obviously gone. Dan Torres?
Here.
Okay, Lee Mercer. Since Shipman's not, we'll have Lee come up. Okay.
Let's go, guys.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Sean Parkman. I'm a member of SEIU 503, and I am the vice chair of the Public Employees Benefit Board. I am testifying today on behalf of SEIU 503. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2387. Rising pharmaceutical prices are undermining PEB's goal to keep costs low. From 2014 to 15, costs experienced by PEB for specialty medications increased 28.4%. Our cost for brand prescriptions rose 16.3%, even while the number of brand drugs prescribed went down 5%. This is not sustainable. And it is not a sign of a healthy marketplace. If left unchecked, pharmaceutical prices will force PEB to push a higher cost burden onto members, decreasing their access to life-saving drugs and further eroding one of the pillars of Oregon's middle class. Meanwhile, the profits of pharmaceutical companies have reached truly irresponsible levels. Pharmaceutical prices are largely beyond the influence of the PEB board. This problem is calling out for state legislative intervention. House Bill 2387 contains some of the most effective corrective actions of any state laws yet to be considered. The foreign price cap will provide an immediate solution for extreme price increases. The provision around price transparency will lead to a more predictable and functional market. I urge the committee to consider this issue as urgent and in need of legislation, specifically House Bill 2387, this year. We need a comprehensive approach that shines light on drug prices and reduces price gouging. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your brevity.
All right.
Excellent. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Dan Torres. I'm with Oregon Ask Me. We represent about 25,000 men and women across the state, including a little over 2,000 folks at the Department of Corrections. I want to address specifically something that Representative Nose mentioned in his earlier statement about the cost of Hep C drugs and its impact, particularly on the Department of Corrections budget. In the last biennium, we saw about a 32% increase in the medical supplies line item in the Department of Corrections budget. A lot of that was driven by the cost of the Hep C drug that was mentioned earlier. We know that researchers estimate that close to 30% of the population of people within the Department of Corrections have chronic hepatitis C. And in some cases, it can cost close to $800,000 per month to provide this drug to people in the custody and care of Department of Corrections. We see this as a huge driver of the cost and the budget in the Department of Corrections, and are here to speak in support of this bill as a way to provide transparency, accountability, and hopefully contain some of the costs that are provided with these prescription drugs. It would be great for you to support the bill, and we really appreciate you hearing it and hearing everyone talk today about the great impact that it could have on our state. So thank you very much for your time, and let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Chair Greenlick and committee staff, I'm Lee Mercer. I'm president of Healthcare for All Oregon, and I'm a retired theater owner. Healthcare for All Oregon is a statewide coalition of 120 organizations, 150 businesses, and 20,000 healthcare advocates around the state dedicated to the creation of a universal, publicly funded healthcare system in Oregon. Until we reach that ideal, we support efforts to increase access, reduce cost, and improve the efficacy of healthcare in Oregon. We are concerned about this issue because, as we all know, the U.S. has the highest per capita healthcare cost in the world, and two of the largest cost drivers are the complex insurance system and the cost of drugs, out of control because we're unable to negotiate drug prices in this country other than in the Veterans Administration. We want to thank Representative Noss for his heroic efforts on this work group. We actually attended most of the meetings, really appreciated. As a layperson, I learned a lot about PBMs and all the arcane complexities of the pharmaceutical market. And we observed, kind of as lay people, the power struggle in the room between insurance and pharma as the two key. Patients don't have a large voice, but pharma and insurance seem to have a large voice. And what I appreciated about Representative Noss and the people from pharma and the insurance companies represented was they tried to build a bill that was balancing taking the hit by both of the industries. Apparently, maybe we didn't find that balance, as at this point, those large ads in the paper that purport to speak for patients, but actually obviously represent the people that are taking the biggest hit in this. I would just encourage the stakeholders in this to return to the table and try to balance this bill, if it isn't balanced now, to create what we need. But last night, I emailed each of you at 9 p.m. a link to a new film that is in national release in a couple of more weeks by a gentleman named Richard Master, who's CEO of MCS Corporation in Pennsylvania, that did a film last year called Fix It, Healthcare at the Tipping Point, that we showed around Oregon to Rotary Clubs, to business groups, et cetera, that makes the business and the economic argument for a universal publicly funded healthcare system. His new film will be coming out in a couple of weeks. You have a link to a 30-minute and a 51-minute version.
Could you wrap it up, please?
Yes, and I encourage you to watch this film. It's called Big Pharma Market Failure. It is really informative, and we're in support of this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Committee, we're going to hear a couple more people, but what I intend to do is to hold a work session on this bill that we can have a discussion among ourselves in the committee and talk out some of the issues that I think are on all of our minds. It would seem to me to be a useful thing to do. You have some amendments coming out of this.
I have one so far, but I'm going to bet there are going to be others, Mr. Chair.
I think it would be good for us to be able to ask some of the questions of each other that's going on here, and to be able to invite people who we want to hear from as well. Yes.
Rep. Kenemer wanted to hear from DCBS.
Okay. Can we have a DCBS representative?
Tasha Sample and Eric Cutler, please.
We don't have anybody coming in behind us.
Is this the end of the test?
Did we get? No, we have pages? We have 1, 2, 3, 4 more.
Four more.
Excuse me. They didn't need to come up and interrupt. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it would be.
Well, a lot of them doubled over.
Okay.
Oh,
thank you. Mr.
They signed up twice.
I think the issue is this question of to what extent would any windfall, if you will, in quotation marks, be counted in the rate setting for the insurance companies in the next session. It would be very helpful.
Chair Greenlick, for the record, my name is Eric Cutler. I'm the product regulation manager for the Division of Financial Regulation, and I have the great privilege to work with the folks that do the rate review for the state of Oregon for individual and small group. And I'll keep it at my level, which is the 30,000-foot level, because I'm not an actuary. If there was going to be an all-equal, no changes in the drug costs and the expense medical trend went down, we would actually require the pricing to go down with it.
There you go.
Simple. That'd be simple. It's a very transparent process.
Actually, on a different track, I have a different question I'd like to ask.
Go for it.
And that is, what percentage of health insurance sold in Oregon is subject to the rate-setting procedures that are under consideration in this House bill?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kennemar, I don't know the actual percentage, but what we review is only going to be for the individual small group market only.
So that's about
it's
what
around 40%.
Less than 40%. But the
individual
number.
We certainly can take that back and give you that percentage.
The part that we can regulate.
Thank you. I
think it's 40.
That.
We'll do.
The totally regulated insurance is what we're talking about.
No,
PEP, they're in the bill.
But that's not part of this. They're not part of DCBS.
They're not regulated by DCBS.
So that, I think that's. We have that a part of our work group we talked about, because that's, I mean, that's huge. That goes to the exact issue that everybody is up here talking about.
Well,
and they're not
okay, thank you. Let's have the last four.
Oh, is that
that's okay. Sufficient. We're timed, and we'll have other times to discuss this other stuff.
Yeah, I think we
but
will. We'll
I
have
do
some
think we want to
we'll have some resources in the room that we can work with.
That's correct.
This would be a useful discussion at any rate. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to get it on the record.
You call the next panel.
John Bartholomew, Jesse O'Brien, and I think it's Rita Adamshire.
Adamski.
I'm sorry?
Adamski.
Okay. Boy, did I miss one.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon, organization with over 500,000 members across the state of Oregon. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2387 due to its comprehensive approach in addressing this complex issue. I was honored to be part of the task force that worked on this proposal for months and months and months. And in part, I was excited to be part of that because this is an issue that is a national issue. We've been working on this at the federal level for many, many years, trying to find some solutions. I've provided a lot of written testimony that talks about what we've supported historically at the federal level, what we support at the state level, why we like this proposal. But because of time, I just want to briefly mention how this impacts individuals. We asked a bunch of our members, share your stories about how this impacts you. And some of the responses we got had, well, most of the responses had key themes. One is that for them, their costs are increasing, but their income is not. If you're retired on Social Security, living on a small pension, you do not have an opportunity to raise your income, although we did see a lot of people who went back to work because they had to be able to pay for their prescription drugs. There's many people who buy their medications straight up and some that go through insurance. For both of them, their costs are increasing. Many people go without their medications or cut back because of the costs. And many people are choosing between medications and other needs like food, housing, and utilities. Couple examples, Mark and Corvallis noted, I have to split my pills in half in order to afford them. Susan and Redmond said, I've been given prescriptions that are over $350 a month, which I cannot afford and still be able to live. We are on Medicare and Social Security with a small pension and are barely able to pay our bills. Mike and Gates.
Don't be wrapping up, please.
Yes. You have a lot of this in your written materials. I urge you to take some action this year. Obviously, we're going to have continued discussions about this, and we really need to be paying attention to how this affects the individual consumers. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Rita Adamski, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2387. These days, I must travel lightly since I struggle to have health insurance. No hang gliding this week. Beginning in 2004, I purchased health insurance on the individual market with every year a steep price increase. Then one year, my medical expenses, including prescription drugs and insurance, cost more than half of my income. Relief. In 2014, I qualified through the Affordable Care Act. Now I'm back to tiptoeing. In February, I qualified for Medicare, and my insurance company canceled me. Medicare is fine. However, I've applied for both Part A and B twice. Both times, the card arrived with only Part A. Yesterday, I again reapplied, and I hope the issue is resolved. Because until they accept me for Part B, I can't purchase a Medicare supplement. And until I can, I am only taking part of my two prescriptions per day. Doctor prescribed two of my medications are three times a day. I'm cutting back to two times a day because I can't afford to have these prescriptions refilled. I have to tiptoe, go slow. And don't get me started on the EpiPen. I would like
we'll
your help.
We'll try not to get you started.
I would like your help by making prescriptions more affordable.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, and I was a member of the interim task force that helped develop this bill, and I am very pleased and excited to be here in support of this legislation, which I think is one of the most important bills that you will be hearing this session. I would love to spend some time talking about why I think this is hugely important. This is the number one issue in healthcare that we hear about from our members these days, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to make a few very specific points. I did submit detailed written testimony. One is that, and I think some of you, possibly all of you, know the background of this, that OSPIRG has worked for many years as a voice for consumers in Oregon's health insurance rate review process. I wanted to go back and look at some of the numbers to illustrate how rising prescription drug costs are impacting premiums in the state, because this problem is not just impacting the people who have to purchase medications out of pocket. It's also impacting all of us through rising health insurance premiums. Looking at the six largest health insurers in Oregon, we found that the average projected increase from 2016 to 2017 in prescription drug costs was 10.52%, and the average projected increase in all other medical costs was 5.07%, so less than half. And of course, those are projections, and I always like to say predictions are hard, especially about the future. So we also looked at the experience of Oregon's insurance companies, which is unfortunately only available up to 2015. And in that, we looked at the per member per month costs for prescription drug costs increase from 2014 to 2015 was 22.04%, and for all other medical costs, it was 12.57%. And just to be as accurate as possible here, I should point out that per member per month costs can swing around a little bit depending on how many members you have. So that exact number should be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt, but that doesn't affect the relative difference between prescription drug costs and all other medical costs. And frankly, all of these numbers are alarming given Oregon's goal of keeping health insurance inflation to 3.4%, but it's clear that prescription drug costs are contributing far more than their fair share to this problem. We think HB 2387 is a good first step toward addressing this. And I did want to, I know this is going back in the hearing a ways, but I did want to address the comments from Representative Hack and Representative Bueller earlier. In response to Representative Hack's question about whether we can assure that this would result in lower premiums, definitely want to see this reflected in lower premiums. That's our goal. What I think I can assure everyone, at least in as much as a consumer advocate and not an insurance company could make this assurance, is that if this works as intended, and I believe it will reduce the impact of one of the biggest contributors to rising premiums. There are a bunch of other contributors to rising premiums, and if those continue to go up, then absolute premiums may go up. And of course, there's also a lot of uncertainty about the future of federal health reform that is potentially going to impact rates. So I can't say that rates will actually go down, but this will affect a major component of rising premiums. In response to Representative Bueller's question about tying insurance rates to rates in other developed countries, I think that's an interesting idea.
Next week.
there's a clear difference between the insurance industry and the prescription drug industry in this context, because the insurance industry has to be able to set premiums at a level so that they can actually pay claims based on the costs that confront them. And one of the roles of rate review is actually to make sure that rates are sufficient. And I would be concerned that if we didn't have a rate review process and we just tied things to what was going on in other countries, that wouldn't work, and it would make the industry not work, whereas the pharmaceutical industry is actually selling drugs in those countries and has been able to make that work. And I would finally say, you know, if we believe that this would result in briefly.
It's
one comment,
Chair,
please.
Can I be in, please?
That's tortured logic.
It's not tortured logic.
Can I make one more very brief comment, please? I just want to say, if we thought that this would result in a windfall for the insurance industry, we would absolutely oppose this bill. We do not think that will happen. I could go on at some length about why, but I will not.
Prefer
Thank
you don't. All right. Brief comment? Let's bring VJ Kavner.
The day is long.
No, I do, actually, yeah. Thank you, Chair. While I appreciate your comments, at the end of the day, I have a responsibility to my constituents who get me here to ask those questions and to clarify that without a doubt, if I take a vote like this, that I can answer to them at the end of the day that they will have a reduction in premium, that they will have better access to prescriptions, so that all of the people that come and see us and that we answer to will have access to prescriptions. And when they do dump the bag on our desk, and they do have to choose between eating and having prescriptions, that we do ask those tough questions. So we will continue to. And if you can guarantee me that, then let's have a conversation.
Chair Green, like Representative Hack, really briefly, I really appreciate that, and I feel the same obligation toward OSPRG's members and the general public and Oregon consumers. I think maybe one way of putting the guarantee I could make is that if we do this and it works as intended, premiums will be lower than they otherwise would be, which I think is a step in the right direction.
That's probably more accurate.
Last comment. Now, we'll have a big discussion about it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
What we got left?
BJ.
Just BJ.
Just BJ.
BJ, you want
to? Okay.
Just BJ.
Right. See, I'm sorry. You're all alone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is B.J. Kavanaugh, and I serve as Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are a chronic health care advocacy group in Portland, and it was also my privilege to serve on this work group. You know, we need to have a party of some type for the survivors of the work group. I think that's at least we can do. I'm here today to oppose this bill, House Bill 2387. It is not what we were looking for with the contributions that we made from the work group. We're concerned about a number of things. Number one, the $10,000 amount that triggers looking at drugs is disproportionately targeting people with specialty health concerns, and it looks like a form of adverse tiering, if not a type of discrimination. I can tell you myself that the two medications that keep me alive cost $32,000 a year. There is no generic equivalent. One of them just came to market 3 years ago, and so this is the very real thing. If a manufacturer of that medication were not able to meet the accommodation set forth by the bill and DCBS, what happens to my access to that medication as a patient in the state of Oregon? There's a lack of transparency in the bill. One of the things that we spoke about was the need for transparency across the board. We talked about having transparency not only for pharma, but also having transparency for insurance plans. Specifically, we wanted to know, and I believe this is fair. We wanted to know what our plans are paying to acquire the cost of a medication, what their profit is, and how they make decisions about whether that medication goes on a lower tier or a specialty tier. We think that's fair. We think that is important information that patients deserve to know so that we can make better informed choices. Part of the large part of the problem with healthcare is we don't actually pay the amount of a product. We pay a portion of, and so people don't understand exactly what they're paying for. So the more transparency, hopefully we'll be able to have better literate healthcare literate consumers making better choices. I'd like to remind the committee that insurers were opposed to covering people like myself and people with pre-existing conditions not that long ago. And so there is a great deal of mistrust in patient groups around this, and there is fear that if this bill is to go through, that there will not be the protections in place that patients need. And to add some reality to that without adding fuel to the fire, the uncertainty as to what's going on at the federal level. We don't know what the future of the Essential Health Benefits Plan is. We don't know what the future of patient protections is. Representative Walden's bill notwithstanding, we don't know if we're going to be able to continue to have these patient protections that we now have under the Affordable Care Act for patients in Oregon. We fail to see how this is going to lower the cost of drugs or health care in Oregon. It looks to us as if the bill is potentially discriminatory, as I said, and we've heard some people speak to how they feel it will work, and it's nebulous at best. If one of you is able to explain it better, I would be happy to sit down with you and listen to what you have to say. But we are concerned about this bill, which does seem like a gift more to insurance companies and forces patients in pharma to be in negotiation at the point of a sword. This feels like a kickback. It's unfortunate. You know, I speak for patients.
What proportion of your organization's budget is financed by pharma?
I beg your pardon?
What proportion of your organization's budget is financed by pharma?
Up until we received our nonprofit status in 2016. We've not yet filed our 990s for that year. Prior to that, we were a program of Molly's Fund Fighting Lupus. Our program budget was approximately $75,000. The total Molly's Fund budget for the year was $3 million. I estimate about 10%.
Thank you.
I came to advocacy as an activist. I started doing this work when my friends were dying in New York from AIDS. So I take umbrage when my intentions in this work are brought into question.
It's not your intention. It's a matter of transparency.
It's a matter of transparency, but it's also the matter of I would hope that working with you all, that you've known me as a person of integrity, And when we speak these issues and when we talk about these things, this is not, we're not carrying the mouthpiece of pharma. We're talking about the concerns of patients. I submitted a petition that was signed by over 2,000 people, and I'd like you to read some of the comments that people have around high deductibles and around not being able to afford insurance and the concerns that they have. And yes, there are concerns about medication costs in there as well, but this is 2,000 people with the majority of them being from our state.
Mr. Chair, I can't resist. I just say that I've seen the petition because it's targeted at me, and while there are certainly comments about deductibles and insurance, there are also plenty of comments about the high cost of medications.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to make a comment, too.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I had I was going to say privilege, I'm not sure that's the correct word, of serving on the work group. And I think the president did have an accurate statement. It is healthcare is complex. And it was an amazing education for me and a painful one at best. And I guess a couple of thoughts that I would like to share after spending those hours and some of the time, I guess one of the concerns I have about this specific bill is that nationally about 10% of the medical cost equation is pharmaceuticals. In Oregon, it's hard to know. It's somewhere between 11 and 17%, depends on who draws the numbers, but I think those are the ballparks. So I have some concern that we have to realize that we probably can't adjust 100% of the equation on some small percentage of the problem. But I agree, it's a horrific problem, and I'll never forget sitting in the mobile home with one of my tenants as she explained to me that she was taking her heart medication every third day instead of daily because she couldn't afford it. And I got that fixed, incidentally. But secondly, I guess another thing that I want to mention is I think, you know, we need to also put this in the larger context of healthcare. And I think we need to figure out what we're going to do about hospital reserves and insurance reserves.
We're going to work on that.
And I also think, as a former provider, we probably need to have a pretty long discussion about the outrageous amounts of money that some providers charge.
The issue about pharma being a small proportion of the total cost of medical care is true, but the problem is it's a fairly large proportion of the increase in cost.
Yeah.
I think it's probably at least half of the increase in cost related to the increase in pharma.
And I think that's a fair critique, but it is. But that's
what
also
makes it a
looking
big
into
issue.
The future.
Mr. Sherp, yesterday.
Let me say to you the reason that I'm. The reason I was asking that question is I saw the story in the Business Journal how you're mm-hmm. so opposed to this bill. We got to this bill because you came in with the $100 copay cap.
Right.
And one of the things that's right in the heart of this bill is that $100 copay cap.
Yes.
So your members will immediately be affected if we pass this bill. The sense that there's some sinister thing lurking in the background that will negatively affect your members really eludes me. So I'm really surprised by the fact that you're here opposing the bill rather than supporting it, since at the heart of the bill is something that started the whole process that you asked for.
Mr. Chair, members, it's not, frankly, the copay language is not strong enough, which is why we are supporting.
Stronger?
Well, we're
you
supporting
have a suggestion
the bill.
Make it stronger. The intention is that that be very strong.
I'd be happy to sit down with you and with the representatives there from Leukemia and Lymphoma Society.
Would that change your opposition if we had the strongest copay language that you can create?
I think what would change opposition is not forcing people to negotiate at the price of a sword and answer the question very clearly, what happens if a drug manufacturer is not able to meet the threshold test? Would that drug then still be available for patients, and how would they access it? The concern here is that there is currently such a nebulous legal quagmire that insurance plans could decide that they don't want to have certain drugs on their formulary. And while we...
Decide that now. There's nothing that stops them from deciding.
Well, no. Under the essential health plan, they have to have one drug in every class. That's required by law. But if that goes away and there's not legislation in place to make that choice, what happens to people like me? What happens to people who take expensive biologics?
That's something we need to be dealing with when we worry about what's happening to ACA, which I guarantee you we're worried about.
I agree.
Well, we're going to have lots of time to discuss this. Sure.
Mr. Chair, if I believe Representative Woods.
We better get
Mr. Chair, please.
We're way over here. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2116. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2387. Well, you're in the longest bill we have had.
Hey, touche.
Do you have your car?
Touche.
Do you have your car?
The longest bill we have had.
Hey.